Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Business Exam Room podcast brought to you by the company Doctors. And I am Randy McKinley, the president and CEO. Today, we've delivered 53 successful business turnarounds using our Forever ROI algorithm. Our dream team of experts has 115 years of hands-on experience and includes two PhDs, a digital marketing expert, an IT specialist, a media PR professional, a former bank president, and myself, a turnaround guru with 25 years of hands-on expertise with Fortune 100 companies, all the way down to many mom and pops. Add in six proprietary diagnostic business assessments that show where the hidden treasure map in a business is, and you can see how we consistently deliver results. In this podcast, we're going to take the most relevant or painful issues facing a business. We're going to dissect it. We're going to take what's complicated and make it simple. Share our secrets and techniques from our toolkit, because 81% of all business closures were not due to a competitor, and 50% of all businesses fail in 5 years, and 60% make no money. So what you don't know or know and don't fix will likely kill your business. So let's get you in the know and make sure you have some of our tools in your toolkit to make your business a little bit healthier. Now, before we tackle today's hot topic, here's a quick note from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by Paul Carney, certified accounting firm. Their expertise in estate planning, new business formation, tax planning, tax prep, and problems with IRS is second to none. They are determined to keep you in the know, and as a result, supply the most updated information in these areas for free on their website. Book your free consultation today by visiting pcarneycpa.com or call 626-358-4205 or drop them an email at paul@pcarneycpa.com and experience the personal professional difference for yourself. Welcome back, podcast fans. I think it's about time we kicked on these bright lights, shined it down on that exam room table, took our topics, ripped it apart, put it back together. And what's those topics for today? There's multiple. The first one, trust. We're going to demystify trust for you. And the second one is CPAs, how not to spend a lot, but get a lot out of them. And the third one is taking some real life examples of COVID has changed the game. Sometimes bigger isn't always better. And we reached out to somebody in California to help us with that. And that was Paul Carney CPA firm. And the reason we reached out to Paul is because he does such a great job of taking what's complicated and making it simple. So it's easy to understand when you're getting into the terms of talking about how to deal with the CPA as well as trust. So kick back, relax, and enjoy the roundtable with Paul as we tackle these topics.
Graduated college in 1981.
Where at? Where'd you go? Where'd
Cal
you go
State to school? Fullerton. Yeah, I was there when they won one of the pennants. Then I went to work a local public accounting firm. Worked there. Well, I worked at two of them for a combined of about total of about 6 years. And I like the small firm because they, as I mentioned to you, I've always liked tax. And they typically, when you start in public, particularly with a larger firm, you don't really get to go into tax. Now I think they give you, based on my daughter's experience, they give you maybe some options. So, but then I went into private industry for I think about 8 years, 7 years. Years. And then I was at a firm where things started going south. And then I decided to start my own firm in 1994, because that's what I knew how to do. Then I got up, brushed my teeth, went to work, stayed late, and went home. Since then, it's just started off as a generalist, I guess you'd say. Since then, we've done a lot more specific areas. Right now, in fact, literally right now today, work to do a fair amount of estate and trust stuff, which I kind of like. And as far as industries, you know, we have a handful of different industries. So, and I've had a number of people in the real estate related people, landlords, developers, some construction companies. But again, it's really more, I tend to just gravitate toward who can I help from a tax standpoint.
Well, I would think it's estate, trust. Do those have a big impact on, not on current tax, but future tax status? Am I correct?
The typical scenario would be somebody's been bugging you to go get a trust done. And you say, fine, I'll go get it done. I go to an attorney, pay him a few grand. And then you say, okay, I got it done. Now what? Well, you put it on the shelf, or, you know, it just disappears. You don't look at it. You don't know what it means. So it's something that you're told you really need to do, should do. It might save you some taxes. It might say, you know, it's going to help your kids. And those things are all potentially well and good, but if you don't really understand it. A more typical scenario would be, I get a call, hey, my mother died, or you know, dad died. Now mom's got stuff. And do you have a trust? Yeah, we have a trust. Okay. A lot of people don't really understand what that means. So a trust by itself doesn't save you any taxes, at least not initially. What it does, it has legal ramifications once the grantor, person who created the trust and who's the original trustee, passes away. I won't bore you with the details.
No, but I think this is good. I think people need to understand this, you know, because there's a big difference between a trust and a will. And, you know, one's probate, one's not probate.
That is correct.
So since you are handling trust, what's the major advantage?
Well, you mentioned one of them is you can avoid probate to the extent that assets are in the trust. So one of the parts, so you go to an attorney puts together a trust. That's step one. Step two is what they call funding the trust, which makes sure that your assets that belong in the trust are titled to the trust. Because if you, I'll give you an example, a guy who had a trust, had his house in a trust, went to refi his house. What lenders will tell you sometimes is, you know, you don't own the house. The trust owns the house, even though a trust is just a piece of paper. You know, it says Randy's trust and that's it. Okay, so what do I do? Well, what you got to do is you got to pull it out of the trust, at least for the, you know, the couple of days or a week or whatever it takes to get the loan done. Then you can put it right back. Well, this guy passed away in the interim. When he passed away, he did the right thing, but then he undid it and boom. So bottom line is it took an attorney quite a while to get that put back in. So, you know, again, funding the trust is important and making sure the assets stay in the trust. So what the trust does, again, besides avoiding probate, you have what's called an estate tax, not to be confused with an estate income tax. Those are two different things. What the trust does is allow you to, so typically it's a husband and wife and you create a trust and I'm going back and forth, but I'll hopefully tie it all together.
Yeah.
It allows each individual to have $11.7 million, I think, estate tax exclusion. That means the first $11,700,000 approximately of assets are not subject to an estate tax. Estate tax is a tax on your assets as opposed to an income tax. So if a husband and wife do it, you double that. So it's a little over $23 million of assets that can be protected from an estate tax if it's handled properly.
That's huge.
It is huge. And I think there's a real strong chance given the current administration that number's, I mean, it's been predicted for a while that number was at 5 million for a number of, it was at $600,000 for a really long time. And almost 20 years, it's crept up, you know, to 1 million and 2 million and 3.5 million and so forth. Anyway, prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was enacted in January of 18, it was 5 million, actually about 5.5 million. Then it jumped up to 11 million. Actually, I'm sorry. I think it jumped up to 10 million and then it's been indexed since then. But anyway, that number is probably going to come down. So what does that mean? Well, that means that people who do that type of planning can probably expect a lot of business in the near future. To give you a short version to say, okay, if you say, look, Randy, you're the first $11.7 million of your assets are not going to be subject to estate tax when you pass away. Okay. You're not going to lose any sleep over that state. Most people are not. Most people are not in that stratosphere. But if it comes back down to something where it was before, which is probably could be 5 million, could be 3.5 million, could be a million. I mean, now suddenly, that type of planning becomes really, really important.
Because you talked about assets, but there's the second part of that equation, which is the income tax. Can you talk about that a second?
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, just in general, the estate tax is on your assets, your house, your car, your securities, whatever. The income tax is on income. There is an estate income tax too, which is a tax on the income in your estate. But those are, that's different.
And how do they define that? So,
well, income is income. Income is what you get for producing your goods or services. So it's what you get paid. You have a job and you get paid for your job. That's income.
So how did you get paid through a trust? That's the question.
There's two different taxes. One is on, okay, you file an income. Most everybody files an income tax return every year. Okay. That's a tax on your income and you get deductions for it. We all know that. What I was referring to is there's also an estate tax, which could apply once you pass away. And that's where you get to shelter 11.7 million of your assets. So they're two different things. You can have one and not have the other.
Okay.
You file an income tax return. You're never going to, you'll either never file an estate or, well, you won't, somebody might, because you won't be around, but so, there may be an estate tax return filed for your estate at some point, if it makes sense, if your assets are in, are at a level where it makes sense or is legally required to do that. And like I said, that number today for an individual is over 11.7 million. For a married couple, it's double that. So very few people now are required to file an estate tax return. Because again, it's only if you're, A, you got to be dead, and B, your assets have to exceed 11.7 million per person.
Is a lot of your business income taxes, doing trusts?
My function would be that if you said, well, okay, Paul, if you're saying I need a trust, why would I need a trust? What does it do? What does it not do? That's where I could come in handy. Because I think to some extent, I think I do a pretty good job, and I do a better job, I think, than a lot of attorneys do in terms of explaining what it actually means. I think, and that's, you know, not that I'm a genius, it's just that I deal with it from a more practical side, whereas they're dealing with it from a more theoretical, esoterical side, where, you know, it's just, you know, filling in, customizing a boilerplate trust agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, imagine just for a second, if I took an average small business and I put them in front of you,
mm-hmm.
and you had a minute to tell them why they need a trust. Most of these are with their S corporation or an LLC, because those flow straight through on their. Mm-hmm. So if I'm looking at that individual, what would their motivation be, or what would be the reasons for them to have a trust?
Well, again, you mentioned it earlier. One is to avoid probate. Second is to avoid the estate tax, or potentially reduce the estate tax. Okay. A more practical reason, if you say, I mean, again, most people don't have $11.7 million in assets, even when they pass away. Mm-hmm. What would be the motivation at that point? Well, I could give you some practical reasons. Most practical reason is what you do when you create a trust is you're creating control of your assets from the grave. In other words, when I pass away, this is who I want to get this. This is who I don't want to get that. If you have a problem with it, then whoever's the trustee at that point will show you the door. So you're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for your beneficiaries. You're trying to minimize their headaches, trying to minimize whatever costs could be involved in allocating. I mean, if things go into probate, I don't know if you've ever been through probate, but it's not a pleasant experience in the sense that, you know, you're not in control of your own destiny. The courts will decide what's going to happen with the deceased assets. So you want to have control. It's like anything else. It gives some organization. It gives, theoretically, save some money, gives you opportunity to set things up in a potentially a tax advantageous way. Again, not so much for you. It could be for the estate, but it could also be for the beneficiaries.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So it sounds like no matter what, everybody probably should have a trust, if I'm hearing it correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say everybody. You know, if you're sleeping under a bridge, maybe you don't need a trust. But if you have children, if you have, you know, a reasonable amount of assets, again, it, you know, California, the probate kicks in when your assets exceed $150,000. So, you know, if you own a piece of property, no, it's not. So from that standpoint, yeah, if you own a home in California, then yeah, you could use that as a simple argument to say, yeah, trust makes sense. Also, if you own real estate at all, in other words, even if you have a small piece of land you paid, you know, $5,000 for forever ago, that's potentially, if that's your only asset, that's still potentially subject to probate.
Boy, that's good to know. And that's probably, are the rules very similar? I would think they're probably very similar in other states as well.
Yeah, I think in general, yeah. I mean, the numbers might be a little different in different states, but yeah, that's more common than uncommon.
Well, podcast fans, what a great spot to take a break and do a quick recap. As you can tell, living trusts are important. And it doesn't really matter who you are. If you have an asset, a house or something, whether you're a small business owner or not, it probably makes sense to have a trust. And it's not that complicated. So the key is it's just protecting you from probate, and you don't want things being in court, being left up to a judge. Hopefully you learned something. Let's take a quick break and we'll catch you on the next side for part two. The Company Doctors has helped 68 companies grow their business, sales increases of 13%, 127,000 more sales dollars on average annually. Do you wish you could get sales results like that? Well, you can. The Company Doctors Ultimate Sales and Marketing Growth Package can make that happen. How's it possible? 3 proprietary assessments that show a 360-degree view of your sales and marketing, 2 virtual war room problem-solving sessions, a 30, 60, 90-day action plan, P&L analysis to find wasted expense so it can be moved to sales and marketing, complete access to our 142 competency courses for 1 year, 100% money-back guarantee, valued at $4,275, available for a limited time to our podcast listeners for only $4.99. To schedule your complimentary business review, email us at clients@thecompanydoctors.com, or you can call 866-387-5314 or visit thecompanydoctors.com. And let's get your company out of the COVID stagnation with our proven sales and marketing action plan today. Welcome back, podcast fans, from that quick break, and I think we're ready for part two. But part one, just a quick recap. Living trust. Almost everybody needs one. If you own an asset, a home, something of that nature, you need to protect yourself from having something land into court. But a living trust protects you. So whether it's a business or an individual, great learning and great education from Paul. Now we're ready for part two, ways to use a CPA without spending a lot of money, but you can get a lot of benefit out of it. All right, talk to you in a minute. What's some of the biggest misses if you had a chance to put 20 people in front of you and go, here's some things that you need to be aware of in your business from a tax planning standpoint for your business?
Don't start the sentence. Don't speak in sentences of past tense. Speak in terms of what you want to do or going to do. Once you've done it, you've probably shut some doors. I bought a business. I sold a business. I bought a house. I sold a house. Okay. That's all past tense. My ability to help you may be somewhat limited once the deal is done. If you tell me ahead of time, then we can do that's what planning is. It's knowing in advance what can or should happen or just presenting options. So, you know, in terms of, I think, you know, we're asking what would I, if I had 20 people in front of me and they, you know, said, look, I'm not happy with my accountant, what could some of the problems be? Or, and the answer, I mean, it could be a lot of things, but again, it's like anything in life, it boils down to communication. And if I know in advance, or at least you tell me in advance, or you somehow plant the seed that something might happen, you're looking in the direction of, you know, fill in the blank, you know, then we can start to have a conversation.
When you look at your businesses that you're dealing with, what's some of the biggest issues that you see across the board with your clients?
Well, you touched on one of them, past tense. Again, drop me a hint in advance of doing something, whatever that something happens to be.
Because it sounds like if you knew in advance, you can give them good advice to mitigate tax.
The answer is possibly. I mean, if you're making a ton of money and you just don't have a lot of, moving pieces that we can play with, then, you know, I mean, I can't, you know, I'm not a magician, but, and I don't have all the answers. There are lots of people in this world that have expertise in various areas. I mean, a good example, you know, common tool we use for taxes is when you buy a property, we'll very often recommend they get a cost segregation study done. And a cost segregation study, you're nodding your head, so maybe you've heard that term before, but what that is it takes, you know, if I buy a $10 million building, historically you'd say, well, I bought a $10 million piece of property and, you know, 30% is land and 70% is building, and I can depreciate the building over 39 years. Well, what a cost segregation study will do is allow you to break that building into smaller pieces, giving you much, much faster write-off. So, I don't do cost segregation studies. That was the point I was getting to, but I know plenty of firms that do it, and, you know, they're fine. I'll farm it out and say, here's, you know, Randy, here's Joe, the cost segregator. Why don't you guys have a conversation, and then I'll step in when necessary. So,
that makes sense. I mean, but see, that's smart. You're pointing people in the right direction so they get the right information, because, you know, you're looking at somebody who's buying a $10 million business. You know, it's kind of important the sooner they can get money back in their pocket is a good thing. Depending how you do your depreciation tables, how you break that out will dictate, you know, how much you get to write off and how much you get to keep versus you have to go pay in taxes.
Yeah. I mean, I was speaking specifically in a building, but you mentioned something else out too, which actually is a good lead into your question. Again, not the past tense. If you're looking to buy a business, there's you know, you can buy the stock, you can buy the assets, but if you either are buying or selling a business or looking into it, again, not past tense, future tense, let's have that conversation ahead of time for a lot of obvious reasons, but some of them maybe buying the stock versus buying the assets. What does that mean? I'm buying the business. What are you talking about? Why are you complicating it? Well, because a Ford is not a Chevy. I mean, you have to distinguish what it is you're buying, and the way like everything else, when there's a buyer and a seller, they're not moving necessarily in the same direction. Seller's looking for the highest price, buyer's looking for the lowest price, but it's not just the price, it's the allocation of the price. How much do we allocate to inventory? How much do we allocate to whatever property they own? How much do we allocate to intangibles like receivables? So those are the kinds of conversations where, you know, any competent accountant is going to be probably really important to have part of that mix. And people, you know, small, bigger businesses, not bigger, I mean, you know, most of my businesses are they're small businesses. They're making, let's say, less than $5 million a year. A lot of them make a lot less than that. You know, as the businesses tend to get bigger, they start to understand that you know, they wouldn't go out. As the business gets bigger, they're going to be more aware of the fact that they really need to have the accountant involved in any kind of decisions like that.
One of the things that you mentioned is that a lot of your businesses are less than $5 million. What's mm-hmm. some of the top issues that these guys are dealing with right now?
Well, I mean, COVID. I mean, let's put it this way. It doesn't really matter the size. If you're a restaurant, although I do even have an exception to that, but most restaurants obviously are in horrible shape. I do have one that's very small. And interestingly enough, her profit is way up this year. And I think it's because she went from, you know, because she had to cut back on so much, she cut back on the labor. I mean, there was a period of time where she would just be the only one going in and making food. Well, that cut her labor costs down. She wasn't, you know, I guess some of the supplies associated with running a business, cleaning and so forth. It's like, you know, it's all takeout anyway. Anyway, obviously, there's a variety. And I have businesses with going both directions. I have, you know, I mentioned to you in the write-up that I've got one client that works with microbreweries and wineries, and they can their beverages. And as the COVID restrictions go up, their profit goes up. So it works both ways. But I mean, COVID aside, because that's universal.
So you gave the example what COVID had hurt her business, and now she's running that business. Interestingly, she's making good profit. And
better profit, yeah.
Better profit.
Right.
And what it tells you is just because you may have a good sized business doesn't mean it's necessarily effectively run. And it's had a traumatic experience. And then it's like, wow, we've restricted. I have a client very similar. They actually had a record profit this last year. And they're down $1 million. It gets into, are you running that business? So it's just because you're growing or you may have a lot of sales doesn't mean you're necessarily taking all that money home. And so it's so funny that you mentioned that. It was just, I was like, wow. It shows that, look, even through hard times, I think people are smart, they're diligent, they take the time to really look at what they're doing, and then they start being much more cost effective. Next thing you know, you look over in the bank account and you're like, oh, hold it, I'm not so bad. It may be, they may be better.
Yeah, and what I find fascinating about that is that that's not something you can probably plug into a software application. I could be the world's greatest consultant because your fee's the highest. Really good chance that you wouldn't come up with a formula to say, you know what, I can make your profit higher even though everything has hit the fan. It just happened. And I guess I think what it goes back to, and I what type of business does your friend or associate
have? Yeah, they are in manufacturing. They manufacture different types of balls, many different types. Small business.
Like sporting, like footballs, or
no, steel, titanium, okay, any material in the world. They even make stuff that went into the space shuttle. They make stuff that goes into nuclear submarines. They make stuff that probably is in your car. They make it probably anywhere. But it's interesting. You know, you have the economy; it's taking a hit, like with several businesses. But I think it's, you know, it's tragic. You see the COVID, but I think it's still, it's good to hear. And I think people need to hear this, you know, like what you were saying with this lady. Sometimes a little bit of a reset will force people to reevaluate. And it's like, hold it. Just because I was bigger doesn't mean I'm going to make more money.
Now they're really finding out how good they are. This woman I'm referring to, her husband died of cancer some years ago. So she's been running on her own, probably going back to the 70s, certainly the 80s. And just the intestinal fortitude that you build up. Again, I can't take any credit for what she's doing. I mean, she's just figured out a way to make this work. So, and that's why, you know, when I'm working with somebody, when I'm consulting with somebody, it's all about listening. It's all about, you tell me what's going on. I don't conjecture. I don't guess. I try to just, you know, keep my mouth shut and say, okay, what, tell me, because I mean, that's the only way I'm going to pick up on being able to actually help them, as opposed to, you know, hey, here's a diagram that'll tell you everything there is to know. So I can't possibly know that. And again, this is proof of that.
What are some of the, you know, some of the metrics a small business should go look at, you think?
Cash in the bank.
Cash in the bank. I love cash in the bank.
Let's start with that one and maybe end that one. The simplest answer I can give to that is look at your balance sheet. And a balance sheet is, you know, that's that kind of a yucky, weird thing that I don't, you know, a lot of certainly smaller businesses don't really.
They have no clue.
Right.
99% of them, they're like a balance sheet. Is that a seesaw?
Yeah.
No,
I get it. I want to know how much came in and how much went out, which the balance sheet doesn't. Well, it gives me the bottom line, but it doesn't give me the details. So I certainly understand why it's not.
So how do they look at a balance sheet, you know, for the average person out there?
They really don't. And see, so in accounting, you know, an accountant, you know, accounting is really a science. I mean, or you can call it an art if you want, but I think it's really more of a science. And so that's the nice thing about a science is it's got formulas to it. You just plug stuff in, and then if it takes you where it takes you. So when I'm doing books, what we do is financial statement preparation. Okay. Client does their, you know, they pay their bills, they invoice clients, they, you know, do, you know, have, give us whatever reports. What we analyze is the balance sheet. If I want to know how much cash do you have in the bank, what are your total fixed assets? What are your accounts receivable? What are your accounts payable? Those are real traceable numbers with source documents you should be able to go to and go, that's the right number. So that's what accountants do. Accountants live and die by the balance sheet. Yeah. I mean, what are my assets larger than my liabilities? By how much? What are my receivables? How many are over 90? How many are over 120? Those are things.
And what's a good healthy number? If, you know, if you look at the average business guy out there, you go, hey, here's your receivables, mm-hmm. here's your payables. What's a good healthy number?
Well, what would you consider? To be honest, if your payables are all over 120, that's not your problem. It's the vendor's problem. But, sort of a rule of thumb, I mean, that I, you know, grew up with, and I don't think it's changed a whole bunch, is your allowance for doubtful accounts, which is a fancy way of saying your uncollectibles. Probably want to keep that at 2% or less. Maybe depending upon the industry, maybe 5% might be acceptable. And to be honest, I mean, when I say whatever, you know, 2%, 5%, you could be factoring in the fact that there are amounts in there that are just not properly accounted for. In other words, the money was collected, it just wasn't properly, you know, accounted for. The company got credits, what have you. So 2%.
And then now, if you look at like accounts receivable versus accounts payable, how many days would you say would be healthy for accounts receivable, consider healthy for accounts payable?
Well, it just depends on the business. If you're a 7-Eleven, it's zero. Okay. If you're, it's such a broad, I mean, if you're a contractor, you know, you're in construction, it could take you years to build something. So most bills say, you know, do within 30 days, right? Ideally less, but I think a lot of businesses can live with 30 days. So, you know, 30 days is probably a good safe average. When you start to veer towards 60, then yeah, probably need to do a little bit of soul searching.
I would agree. Well, podcast fans, we're coming to the end of another great roundtable interview, and that was with Paul Carney. I hope you enjoyed it. And a couple key takeaways from the second part. If you heard that, the world of COVID has been very devastating, but there is a glimmer of hope. Sometimes it causes you to reevaluate, and we had some great examples where sometimes bigger isn't always better, and sometimes shrinking back down can make you more profitable. So there is hope. Take solace in that. And secondly, remember, when the CPA is talking to you, the balance sheet is kind of their Bible. That's the summary, and you live on the P&L, and then they live on the balance sheet, which is really just the conclusion of what you do. And last but not least, trust. Everybody probably needs one, just because if they own an asset, whether you're a business or not. Hopefully you learned something today. So good health to you, your family, and your business, and we'll catch you on the next one. Talk to you later. The information provided is intended solely for educational and cannot be used as a substitute for professional advice and or information, as circumstances will vary from person to person and company to company. You should not act or rely upon information without seeking professional advice. Do not attempt any of the suggestions, actions, solutions, remedies, or instructions discussed on this podcast without first consulting with a qualified professional. The materials are not intended to be, nor do they constitute actionable professional advice. Transmission of this information is not intended to create a professional-client relationship between the company, doctors, and you.